be po' boy. And I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. This is the biggest crowd I've been in since they tried me over in Marietta. God bless you. I'm glad you all came. You are beautiful. I don't know how I got down here. And I don't know who got me. But whoever got me down here, I appreciate it. I never have been to a convention before. I haven't been in this program all that long. I'm just a drunk trying to stay sober one day at a time. Thank God for you wonderful people. Before I got to this program, I did not know how to live. And I did not know how to love. I feel like this afternoon that I am sober and alive by the grace of God and the fellowship of this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am just a little bit old-fashioned, and I'm a little bit countrified. But y'all never would have known that if I hadn't told you. I'm glad somebody told me to quit calling my wife Old Flo. But I'm glad that Flo is with me this afternoon and hear this wonderful introduction that Jerry just gave. She don't hear many things like that about me. And it looks like just about everywhere that I go, I always run into somebody that I knew before I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody's laughing. And this reminds me of a story about an old buddy of mine up in North Carolina, and he stole a man's milk cow, and they gave him 12 months in the chain gang. And when he finished that sentence, he was so ashamed of himself until he moved off down here in Georgia. He got him a job, and he started attending a little old Baptist church out there in the country. And after about 6 months, he established such a good record in the community and in the church until he was elected to the Board of Deacons. And he served in that capacity for some time, and after a while, the preacher resigned, and they asked this old buddy of mine if he would be their preacher. And he accepted, and the very first Sunday morning that he mounted the pulpit to deliver his sermon, he looked down the aisle, and he saw a long-legged joker come walking in that he used to be in the chain gang with. And so he started his sermon off like this, "Brothers and sisters, now, I came here this morning fully prepared to preach to you from the book of John. But said after observing this great congregation, I have changed my text to the second chapter of Jude, where it says, if you knows anything or sees anything that ain't already leaked out, just keep your big mouth shut till this meeting's over with, and we'll talk about it out yonder in the yard." And so it is with me. Now, if you know anything that these other folks don't know about, you just keep your mouth shut. This is my story. I'm telling it, and I'm not telling yours. They told me that when you talk, you tell how it was in the beginning, what happened, and what it's like today. And I have no hang-up on telling you how it was in the beginning, and I'm happy to tell you how it is today. But truly, there was a lot of things that happened along the way that I prefer not to talk about. Because if I was questioned on some of these things, I'm sure I'd have to stand on the Fifth Amendment. It just wouldn't be good for old poor boy to talk about everything. I did that when I taken the fifth step. Whether you believe this or not, I was born about 64 years ago over here in Rockdale County, Georgia. And my daddy was a sharecropper and a moonshiner. And I suppose by the time I was about 10 years old, I could operate a whiskey still just about as good as my dad could. I knew all the ingredients that went into a batch of beer that would cause it to ferment, and then when it was ready to be distilled. So I learned real early. We were just about as poor as anybody could get. We wasn't poor, we was poor. But we loved each other very dearly. And there's two things that stands out in my memory today in the kitchen of this old house that we lived in. There was two things that always sit there. One of them was a jug of shine liquor, and the other one was a jug of sorghum syrup. So other than becoming an alcoholic, I turned out to be quite a syrup sopper. And I still love sorghum syrup. And I suppose when I was just about big enough to wear knee breeches, some of you old folks know what knee breeches was, we moved to the city of Atlanta, and we settled down over in a real prominent part of the city. They called it Cabbage Town. And that is a great part of the city. I don't know why they don't move the capital down there. The streets were not paved, and I think everybody that lived on the block that we moved on to was a produce peddler or a bootlegger. And it was just about time for the Depression to come on, and there wasn't much money in circulation. And I think every little boy that I began to run around with was a graduate from some reform school, or he was a candidate for some reform school. And we have all been young at one time or another, and you know how young folks are. We wanted to be accepted. We wanted to be one of the crowd. And so it was with me. When the rest of the kids' old man would buy them a bicycle, my dad, he couldn't buy me one, and so I'd steal one. And a little bit later on, when the rest of the kids' old man would get them some kind of a hot rod, my dad, he couldn't buy me one, and so I'd steal one. I always had just as much as the rest of the kids, but mine was all hot. And it wasn't too long after this until I learned that the law kindly frowned on some of these things that I was doing. And they had me up in that Fulton County courthouse. And they told my mama, said, "We're going to send your boy to the chain gang. And just let him see what it's all about, and then we're going to turn him out, and I'm sure that your boy will be a better boy." Now, we would believe anything in the world that anybody told us, especially the police. And so this was back in March of 1929. And I went to the chain gang. I was a little old boy scared plumb to death. And I expected to get out that night and no later than the next morning. But it didn't quite work out that way, because they kept me 4 years before they turned me back out. And by that time of mixing and mingling with the so-called hardened criminals, I became a real smart aleck. And you know the kind of person that I'm talking about. I hated everything that stood for law and order, honesty, decency, and respectability. I didn't love but two things in this world. That was old poor boy and a pistol. And I thought that I knew all the tricks of the trade. And so, in this condition, I came back out on the streets of Atlanta. Now, I don't know how old I was when I taken my first drink. It just seemed like I always drank it as well as soft syrup. And I don't know what alcohol did for you, but I am well acquainted with what alcohol did for old po' boy. Now, my story may be just a little bit different from the most stories that you hear. But if you were the kind of drunk that I was, then you are my brothers and sisters in this disease of alcoholism. I just got arrested case today. If it was possible, my mama was more than a mother. We were buddies, we were pals, and she just worshiped the ground that I walked on. And a short time later, in a drunken stupor one night on the outskirts of Atlanta, I wrecked an old automobile and I killed Mama. And I never got over that for a lot of years and a long ways down the road. The nightmares. The screams. Until I taken what we talk about in this program as the third step. When I quit trying to run that railroad myself and turned it over to something greater than I was. I'll tell you a little bit more about that a little further along. A short time later, I was captured, tried, and convicted, and sentenced to serve well over 100 years. My people were still poor, and they could not hire a lawyer. I didn't have any hopes of ever being free again, except to just run out, and I run all my life all over Georgia. From just about every institution that I was confined in, I escaped or attempted to escape. This was my life. This was the only hope that I had. And some of the people that I associated with were not quite as fortunate as I was. Some of them were shot down and killed trying to escape. Some of them were shot down on the streets of Atlanta and killed, and some of them went to the electric chair. Surely somebody up there was watching over old poor boy. And this is why I like to mention by the grace of God that I'm here this evening. I don't deserve this. I broke every rule that the prison system had. And this was back in the days of the old chain gang stocks and the sweat boxes. Whipped with just about everything I could be whipped with, and I just got meaner and meaner. Because you don't win people like this. You might say, well, poor boy, how do you win them? I'll tell you, honey. A little old four-letter word that said love. L-O-V-E, love. Thank God I found out one day that somebody loved old poor boy. And this made the difference. Eventually they built a place down in Tattnall County that we call Reedsville. And I was one of the first inmates to enter this. They do call them inmates now. They call me a convict. And I can't say what else. And they locked me up in a little old cell for 8 months until they opened up a rock quarry over here in Paulding County, and they sent me over into this rock quarry for incorrigibles. And you know, I didn't drink for 3 years over there in that rock quarry. But I managed to escape on two different occasions, and then I was transferred back to Reedsville under what was known as a stop order. Not to be transferred out again under any circumstances. And this is where my knowledge as a little old boy came in real handy of how to make beer. Now, you people out here in the streets, you call it beer, but in the penitentiary, we call it buck. And I am a good buck maker. I could make it so strong, you'd have to have a chaser with it. Some of you people don't understand this, but I drank alcoholically in the penitentiary for many years. I made my own stuff, as well as a lot of other people. We could do that. They can do this. And this is why that I'm so happy today that I have an AA program going on in the Gwinnett County Correctional Institute. Those guys can drink, but I'm very happy at the way this meeting is going on up there. Most of them are young guys. They're getting some education about some things that I never got as a young person. After a while, we got a new warden at Reedsville. And out of 2,500 men, he picked 10 of us with the worst escape records and says, carry these fellows to maximum security. They will never come back to population as long as I'm warden. But we did. 30 days later, we escaped from maximum security at midnight. And we came downstairs and we'd taken over the whole inside of the penitentiary. We just captured that booger. And I walked down those cell blocks with a market basket full of keys, and I turned everybody out that said they wanted to run away. I must have let 100 out. We had the front office under control. We had the powerhouse under control. We turned all the inside lights out, the outside lights, the tower lights, a complete blackout. And there was 25 of us went right out those big front doors and taken automobiles off of the yard. The other 75 went down to commissary and broke in there and got all that juicy fruit chewing gum, brown mule chewing tobacco. They didn't want to run away. They just wanted to steal something that's full of larceny. And so the governor, he offered $1,000 reward, dead or alive, for every one of us. It carried the headlines across this nation. But within another 30 days' time, we were all back in jail. With the exceptions of one 17-year-old boy who was drowned in the river that night. And then they started what was known as the 8-ball squad. Our heads were shaven. They looked like a bunch of nickel watermelons. You can't buy one for a nickel now, buddy, but you could then. And those pick irons were welded around our legs. We were placed in a segregated detail from the rest of the institution. And every state trooper in the state of Georgia had to come to Reedsville and do 10 days guard duty over this particular detail, that they might know these guys anywhere on site. We was not allowed any visiting privilege or any mail privilege or any reading material or even any lights in our cell. We was working out in a stump digging detail. I'm a good stump digger. I don't think anybody in this particular detail was serving less than 100 years, and life looked pretty hopeless. So many of these guys began to break their legs, to break their arms, and to cut their heel tendons, known as a heel strain. And some of them crippled themselves for life. Back in those days, we did not have a pardon and a parole board in Georgia. We did not have a board of corrections. We had a prison commission, which consisted of three men. They were the whole works in Georgia. And so the governor, he picked a group of men to come to Reidsville to make an investigation, then return to Atlanta and make some kind of recommendation. He picked the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, a lot of judges and probation officers, newspaper reporters and photographers, and one other man that I'll never forget as long as I live. His name was Mr. Wiley J. Moore. And Mr. Moore was a millionaire banker in Atlanta, and he asked Mr. Moore if he would head up this group. And so they came to Reidsville, and we were driven out of these muddy river bottoms into this old dark cell house. And Mr. Moore said, "Open the door. I want to go in and talk to these men." And they told him he couldn't come in there because it was too dangerous. Mr. Moore was the first man in my life that I ever heard talk about a higher power, whom he chose to call God. He said, "I prayed before I came down here. And if this is the way God wants me to die, I am not afraid." To me, this was quite a testimony. They opened the door, and Mr. Moore came in, and we followed him to the rear of this old cell house, and we sat down in a big circle. And he sat down in the center of this group, and there he told us about the God of his understanding. He told us that we could not buy this because it was not for sale. He told us that we did not have to be good to get it, that it was a gift. Man, I could not understand anything like this. But I had all the respect in the world for this man because he was for real. He could do a lot for us and we couldn't do anything for him. He said, "I'm going to take the stripes off of you, the chains off of you, and I don't care how many life sentences you are serving. If any man in this particular detail will do 5 years with a perfect record, I guarantee parole." There was only one man in this group that taken advantage of that great opportunity. I'm not breaking his anonymity. He is not in the program. He never took a drink or lick in his life. His name was Forrest Turner. He did do 5 years. He was paroled. He's an old grandpa now. Never been back in. "Mr. Moore," said, "I'm going to let you pick any job in this institution that you want, that you might learn some trade. That'll be worthwhile to you someday." And you know what kind of job I asked for? One down in the steward's department. That's where they got all that meal and sugar and syrup and yeast. I'm an alcoholic. I intended to stay drunk, and I did. For the next few years, there was a lot of things that happened. A lot of them were tragedies, and I prefer not to talk about this. I like to look on the humorous side of things. And I had a real good buddy that we called Hitler. Now, Hitler was a little small fellow in stature. He'd weigh about 75 pounds, soaking wet. And if there's anybody in this world that loved Buck as good as I did, it was old Hitler. And so one day I made Hitler drunk, and he got arrested on a plain drunk charge, and they had him down at the control office. And the warden said, "Hitler, where did you get that buck at?" And he pulled off his hat, and he bowed over real humbly. And he said, "Captain," said, "you can just whoop this old head of mine till it rattles like a pot of okra, and I'll never say one word against my good friend Po' Boy Rice." Now, old Hitler, he swore that he didn't snitch on me. He didn't know how they found it out. But then, just as many times, we would have to go upstairs and eat bread and water for a while. And so I used this little extra freedom that I had of mixing and mingling with the rest of the convicts. Until after a while, I had me an old pistol smuggled in there and a Prince Albert can full of bullets. And I talked five other prisoners into hecking me, and we wound up with 19 of those free people all tied up in haywire and used them as hostage and tried to go out the back gate. How insane can you get? And I was just about as high as a person can get, all hopped up on buck and on drugs. I didn't even know I was in this world. And I can honestly say, thank God, I didn't get out those gates. I wanted out bad. Because if I'd have got out those gates, I wouldn't have been here this afternoon. Anything that I tell you that happened to me, don't you feel sorry for me, buddy. I asked for it. And so they stripped me off naked and beat me until I was bloody as a hog and drug me to the death house. And I was placed in a little old cell that I could only take three steps over there and three steps back, right in the shadow of the Georgia electric chair, and there I was confined for 2.5 years. Now, I could talk all day about some of the things that happened during those 2.5 years, because during those years, the state of Georgia was leading the nation in executions. I came to believe that there was a God, but I didn't want to accept him. 2.5 years later, I came back to population with a thought like this: I surrender, I give up. When I go again, I'll go out that front door a free man, or I'll go out that back gate in a pine box. I can't beat you. And I settled down for the next 7 years and made what I call a perfect record. Now, I stayed drunk a lot, but for me, I made a good record. And I'd never made a record like this in my life. And by this time, we had a pardon and a parole board in Georgia and a board of corrections. And every year they'd come down there and talk to me and just throw those papers aside and come back in another year and we'd talk again. But after 7 years, Mr. Ed Everett was chairman of this board. And he said, "Now, old cowboy, we feel like you've been in long enough, but you've been too closely confined for too many years to be turned out with the public." The only thing I knew how to do was to dig a ditch or dig up a stump out there in the field. And to tell you the truth, I wasn't fitting to be around decent people. He said, "We're going to recommend that they send you back out to a road camp and let you mix and mingle with the people out there in the county and get used to being around folks again, and then we're going to give you a parole." I didn't understand all this kind of talk. He understood it much better than I did. And so they sent me over to Cobb County. And they told my people, said, "We're going to let him stay up there 1 year, and then we're going to parole him." Well, I felt like a misdemeanor. I'd count the months off, the weeks off, the days off, until this year was up. I'd get up every morning hollering, "Short time." And then they sent me a big, long envelope and said, "Stay another year." And this like to have broke my heart. I couldn't understand these kind of things. But I found out later on that this was for psychological reasons, to see if I could stand a little disappointment. I was a real weak individual. And I had a thought like this: when my people come to see me on Sunday, I'll get what money they got and I'll leave, because I very well could have left then. But all these years that I had been gone, my little brother and sister and them had grown up, they had families of their own, and they had all become Christian people. But they didn't talk to me about God. I guess they just thought I was a hopeless case. Because for the first 50 years of my life, I had no God. I don't know if I was agnostic or what I was. I just didn't say there was, and I didn't say there wasn't. And when I began to raise so much Cain that morning, I hated the state of Georgia, and I wanted them to be just as mad as I was, and they just dropped their head and they began to cry. And I didn't know how to fight anything like this.
My sister told me, she said, I know you don't have a God, but I do. She said, there's a lot of people praying for you that you don't even know. And she said, don't do anything till the Capitol opens in the morning. And I owed her an awful lot. She'd been a second mama to me. And the very next day, they said, now, poor boy, you stay in tomorrow. Somebody's going to carry you to the Capitol. The board wants to talk to you again. And I couldn't hardly sleep on that old bed that night for thinking about this God that my sister had so much faith in. So the first seed was planted when Mr. Moore talked to us down in that old cell house. And then there was another seed planted there. So they carried me to the Capitol. There's a lot of people up there representing me, and I didn't even know them. They just knew my family. And they said, we're going to reconsider your case. And so about 2 weeks later, I was paroled. And I've been in 20 years, 1 month, and 2 weeks then. And back in those days, they did not, if you made parole, they did not give you any clothes. Somebody would have to come and pick you up and bring you some clothes to wear home. And I never will forget, my sister brought me a pair of slack pants and a sports shirt. And this was the first time in my life that I ever owned a pair of breeches with a zipper on them. And that just fascinated the very hell out of me, because I'd stand in front of the mirror and go zip, zip, zip. And so I came back to Atlanta, and it was a far different city from the old Atlanta that I used to run in as a little old boy. And every time that the doors of the church were open, my people all went to meeting. And it was sort of a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. Now, you can go to meeting with us, or you can stay here at home by yourself. And so out of curiosity, I went to meeting. For all the wrong reasons. But there was one wonderful thing that happened to me by going to those meetings. Because this is where I met Flo. God bless old Flo. And it didn't take her too long to talk me into marrying her. She don't tell it that way. We got married and we settled down and we started housekeeping. And some of the men of the church got me a job digging ditches for a plumbing company. I'm a good ditch digger. And after a while, I got to be a plumber's helper. 3 or 4 years later, I got one of those little old cards that said that I was a plumber. I didn't say it. That little old card did. Flo and I was very happy, and I was not drinking liquor. And so I got a job at Emory University, and that's a big thing in DeKalb County. There's a lot of people know as po' boy. You're not supposed to work over at Emory with the kind of record I had. But I worked over there for 2 years. Man, I just flat had it made. I could wear my house shoes to work every morning. And after 2 years, they called me in their office and they said that this old past had caught up with me. And they were going to have to let me go. And so I got mad. I didn't know who I was mad at. And I wanted to get even with somebody, but I didn't know exactly who to get even with. And I just flat didn't have enough guts to go home and tell Flo what had happened. She would have understood and we could have worked it out. So the way I started to get even, every morning I'd let her put that bread and meat in a sack and I'd cut on out like I was going to work, and I didn't have a job and I didn't want one. And I walked into a beer joint and I said, what's the strongest beer you got? And he said, ain't no difference, buddy. It's all just alike. And this is the way I started getting even. And I started drinking. And I started doing a lot of other things that I ought not to have done. And I wouldn't go home around Flo when I was like this. I'd just walk the streets of Atlanta all night and cry. I felt so sorry for poor little old po' boy. Any of y'all have felt like that? We call it the plum disease. And so I got the idea, you know, that I'd run away from it all. I'd just get away from Atlanta and I could straighten myself out, because I tried to quit drinking and I couldn't quit. I'm an alcoholic. And so I left Atlanta and I went to Birmingham and I found out that liquor over there was just like it was over in Atlanta. And I stayed drunk until I went into DT's. And the police picked me up, found out I was from Atlanta, and they wanted me in Atlanta. And they sent me back over to Atlanta and they put me under a $10,000 bond and my people put up their home and everything in this world that they had to get me back out on the streets to stay drunk. I'm an alcoholic. And I can remember one night down at the bus station, I saw one of those Greyhound buses that said Chattanooga. I didn't know anybody in Chattanooga either, but I was still running. And I got on this bus with 2 half-pints of liquor in my pocket, and as soon as he pulled out of the station, I drank one of them. And by the time we got to Dalton, I done drank the other one. I wasn't only drunk, I was crazy. I was insane. Nobody on the bus wanted to talk to me, and I don't blame them. But I looked back in the back, and there was 2 black men sitting back there, and I decided maybe they'd talk to me, and I went back there, and the first one I tried to sit down by him, and he told me he was a minister of the gospel. He didn't want to talk to me either, and so I moved over in the seat with the other guy, and I said, "Do you know anything about this town?" And he said, "I live here." And I said, "Well, show me where to get off of this bus, because I don't think it's a good idea for me to go down to the bus station." And he said, "I don't either." He said, "Just get off with me." And so we got off together, and it was late at night. Everything closed up, and I just had to have some more liquor. He said, "I got a friend that sells some shine liquor. We'll go over there and get some of that." And so we went over there, woke him up, and he just had 1 pint, and he wouldn't sell it to me unless I'd give him part of it. So we all 3 went out to the wood pile and sat down on the chop block and passed that bottle back and forth, and it didn't last but a little bit. And then I stumbled on back up on the main streets of Chattanooga, looking for something to open, and everything closed up. Just had to have somebody to talk to. Just had to have another drink. And directly I saw those neon signs flashing, fancy wines and liquor. I said, "Uh-oh, here it is." But when I got up there, that place was closed too. But it had a big plate glass all the way across the front of this thing. And I could stand on the sidewalk, and these shelves, they came right up to the front, and they were 1/2 pints, pints, quarts, fists. And I hit the glass with my fist, and it fell out all over me and all over the sidewalk, and just stood there and filled my pockets full of bottles. And I'd split my hand wide open, and I didn't even have sense enough to know that I was cut. And so I continued on up the street. My pocket was full of blood. My tie and my shirt was bloody. And I was standing up there, weaving in the wind, trying to light a cigar, when the police run up there and threw a shotgun on me and carried me back down to this liquor store. And I had blood all over me. It was all over this glass and all over the sidewalk, all over these bottles I had in my pocket, all over them on these shelves. And I lied like a dog. I said I didn't do it. He said, "How in the world are you going to deny something like this?" I said, "I don't know, but I am," and I did. And they put me in that Hamilton County Jail in Chattanooga, and they kept me for 5 weeks until the grand jury met, and they failed to indict me. Don't ask me how come. Maybe they didn't want me in Tennessee. I remember they called me down in the office just about dark one evening in the dead winter time, and they opened the door and said, "Get." And I got, because I thought they'd made a mistake, and I run 5 blocks just as hard as I could. But those people had not made a mistake. They just didn't indict me. And so I stumbled around, and I made my way back to Atlanta and back to Flo, just to get what money she had and to continue to stay drunk. I'm an alcoholic. A short time later, an old buddy of mine, Leland Harvey, we'd run together for years. And we were going up that 4-lane highway one evening, both of us drunk on an old Ford. And we had a blowout right in front of a filling station. So we went over there and bought a new tire from the operator. And he said, "Pull your car over in the yard and I'll put the tire on for you." So here we are, 2 drunk fools trying to get this car across that expressway over into the yard of the filling station. And a Thunderbird dealer and his wife from up in Old Howell was on the way to Florida on vacation, and they run over us and tore up our car. And like two idiots, we jumped out there and took the other way from them. How insane can you get? This is some of the things that alcohol would do for me. I never have in my life been arrested for being drunk. But I've been arrested a lot of times for doing things I did under the influence. You know they caught us. And it wasn't so much in what we had done, but, you know, this old past. And so they tried us and convicted us and gave us 20 more years. And I went back to Reeseville. If I'd have had guts enough, I would have cut my own throat. I didn't think I could live to ever get out again. Flo kept on praying. She went out to Piedmont Hospital, got a job working at night from 11 till 7 in the morning. Sleep in the daytime, write me a letter once a week and tell me she still loved me. Beg somebody to bring her to see me every 3 or 4 months. Life really looked hopeless. Thank God, Flo kept on praying. And I like to look at it this way, because 14 months later, I feel that God answered that prayer in a far different manner from anything I ever dreamed of, because I was transferred over to Stone Mountain, Georgia, to install a plumbing in a new prison camp. And when we finished this new prison, the warden had us to install in one end of the mess hall a little chapel. Little thing sort of like this up there. And he called me out in the office and he said, "Now, old poor boy," said, "I got a different assignment for you every Sunday afternoon." Said, "We're going to have a different church group in here every Sunday afternoon for a religious service of all denominations." He said, "Now, I want you to stand here by this door and welcome these visitors when they come in. And," he said, "I want you to lead the singing. And," he said, "I want you to form a choir." How about that for ignorant, uneducated Georgia stump jumper? That's what I was, and I still am. Thank God for that. I'm not trying to change that part of it. And of all the silly things, I wanted to do this. I didn't know how to pray. I had seen people pray. And I like to look at it this way. God began to deal with me in such a way that I was sorry for some of the crimes that I had committed. I call this a godless sorrow. I wasn't just sorry that I had been caught up with. I was actually sorry for the things that I had done. And so I found me an altar. And it was an old black burnt hickory stump out in the woods. And this is where I say I've taken that third step that we talk about in this program. I turned it over. And I said, "God, if there is a God, take what's left the rest of this old life of mine and help me, that I can be a witness for you, that I can help somebody else." I cannot explain to you what happened. Some people talk about it, especially church people, as an experience of grace. I don't know what happened. But since that time, I've never wanted to rob, steal, or kill anybody since then. God did something for old poor boy. If there's anything I know as a Georgia convict, I live with them all my life. They are the most suspicious-minded people in the world. But when I got up from that old black burnt hickory stump and went back into those bullpens, I became a leader. Every time the doors of the church were open, those men would follow me. You don't fool them. They look at you every day and every night. They know what makes you tick. I did welcome those visitors. I did lead the singing. I did form a choir. And the good Lord sent one of them honky-tonk piano players in there, and I put that joker to playing gospel music. And we formed a quartet. And the warden let me go out in the front yard with a bulldozer and build a baptizing pool. And run hot and cold water out there, and we turned it on. Those people did not come out there to bring us a service. They came out there to get one. There was a lady down in South Georgia gave us a piano. Congressman James C. Davis's wife gave us an organ. WSB gave us a PA system. And I like to look at it this way, the God of my understanding don't have to be in a great big hurry about nothing. Because I did this for the next 5 years. I still had that number on the seat of my britches, but thank God I was free. I was happy. I was a different person. The only thing wrong was this. God left me an alcoholic, and I'll be an alcoholic as long as I live. 5 years later, they told me one morning, said, "Po' boy, I just seen Flo go around the corner up there with your Sunday breeches, and it like scared me to death. I thought some of my kinfolks had died, and they had a court order, and I was going to the funeral." But this was not the case. Miss Rebecca Garrett was chairman of the Pardon and Parole Board, and she had paroled me again after 6 years. Flo and I guess we didn't have a dollar and a half between us. We couldn't hire a lawyer yet. But we felt like that we had the best. God had something else for old poor boy to do. And so I remember as we went home that morning, we didn't know hardly how to talk to each other, but we knew where our help came from. And so just about like two little old three-year-old kids, we walked into the bedroom, and hand in hand we knelt down by an old bedstead, and we dedicated our home and our life and everything we ever hoped to be to God, that He might use us to help somebody else. I went back to work at Plumbing Work, and I didn't drink for 6 years. I stayed very busy. Because for about 3 years of that time, I traveled with a gospel singing group, and we traveled all over the South. People couldn't believe what had happened to old poor boy, and they'd send for me, and I'd go, and I'd talk especially to the young people, youth rallies, sing. We were very happy. I had a job working at a motel as a maintenance man. Everything was so well, I had no reason to ever drink again. But I remember it was in the hot summertime, and I thought, I can drink one of them good old cold Budweiser's if I want to. I can take it or I can leave it. I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. But I couldn't, because I got drunk, and I stayed drunk for one solid year. Life really got hopeless then. No purpose whatsoever. Nobody knew what to do with me. And I didn't understand this. I didn't understand why I drank. Somebody told Flo, said, put him in Peachtree Hospital, and they'll cure him. So she put me in Peachtree Hospital, and we spent all the money we had, which wasn't much. They detoxed me, and I came out, and I continued to drink liquor and stay drunk. I had an awful lot of will, but I didn't have no power. I wanted to quit again, but I didn't know how. So I wound up over at Georgia Regional. They detoxed me again over there. I came out on the streets. Continued to stay drunk. And eventually I wound up out at GMHI. And the only thing that made a difference, this would have been just the same old merry-go-round, but on Monday night, they had an AA meeting out there. I couldn't hold a cup of coffee. I was sick. I was scared to death, and I thought I was going to die. I still had faith in God, but I thought God was going to let me die drunk. And at the end of that meeting, there's a very dear lady friend who happens to be my sponsor today that runs the Rockdale House over in Conyers. She came over to me and she said, "Po' boy, do you want to get sober and stay sober?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I sure God do." She said, "Here's my phone number. Call me when you come out." And I think I was about like a drowning man grabbing at a straw. I would have tried anything that you suggested. And so she sent me to my first AA meeting outside of an institution, which is the Glen Haven Stone Mountain Group, where I'm a member now. And I could just imagine all kind of questions they were going to ask me when I got over there. Everything that I'd ever been involved in had so much red tape to it, you know. And I could just imagine somebody say, "Hey, boy, who sent you over here?" Have you ever been convicted of a felony? They always did this everywhere else I went. But it wasn't like that. And I can remember a few things that happened that night in that first meeting. One of them was these guys and gals sit around that table, and every time one of them would open their mouth, they'd say, "My name is so-and-so, and I am an alcoholic." And I thought, "My God, honey, you ain't the kind of drunk I am. I hurt down in my guts." And these people were well people, and they were happy people. And they seemed to care. I asked a lot of questions, and I'm sure I got a lot of good answers. One of the questions I asked, "Hey, what do I have to do to be like you people?" And they said, "Don't drink and go to meeting. Don't drink and go to meeting." I heard that so much it sounded like a broken record. Don't drink and go to meeting. And this is what I did for the first few months. I liked you people. And it seemed like I fit here where I never fit anywhere before in my life after I got out of the chain gang. I fit that very well. I heard these people reading, "If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps." That number one was a big one for me. I got me a big book. I went to meeting every night, triple time on Sunday, and I'd read this book. And when I got over there on page 83 and they began to talk about these promises, oh yeah, I'd heard about these things. And I come to realize that there was a certain thing I was going to have to do if I ever come to realize any of these promises, and that was to get with this thing. And I got with this thing to the best of my ability. I haven't been in the program but 3 years. This is the best 3 years of my life. Somebody told me the other day, "Quit saying you're an old man," but I am an old man. And I've tried everything else in this world, and I never found the love, the peace of mind that I have found in this little old simple program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you ask me how it is today, it's wonderful. I'm not a very smart man. I never have been. But I'm a real happy man. All by the grace of God and the fellowship of this wonderful program. I appreciate you people letting me be down here in Albany. I appreciate you listening to me. God bless you. I love you.